Support comes from Mosby Building Arts, creating finished basements for family fun, fitness, and entertaining. Ideas at callmosby.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio.
I'm Emily Woodbury, in for Elaine Cha. 60 years ago today, the two legs of the Gateway Arch leaned towards each other with just 2 feet of space at the top. The legs were held back by post-tensioned concrete with steel reinforcing and a stabilizing strut. The next day, the final piece of the monument would be set into place. 6 decades later, the 630-foot arch looks as good as it did on day one, remaining a shiny, iconic symbol that frames St. Louis's skyline. Producers Olivia Mizell and Darius Varner took to the arch grounds and the streets of St. Louis to hear how residents and visitors see the arch today.
When you see the arch, what do you think?
The arch is beautiful. It's different. The architect around it is amazing. I've never seen anything like that before.
Amazing. Engineering feat, everything about it, you know, the gateway to the west, the whole idea behind it.
I am just inspired. It's awesome, actually. The color, the metal, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Is this your first time here? What are your thoughts on the arch? Have you been here before? Is it a staple of a trip?
It was definitely a staple of the trip. We're both from Los Angeles, and this is our first time being here to see the Gateway Arch, and I think it's beautiful. You know, I've always wanted to see it because it's so synonymous with St. Louis. We don't come to the Midwest. We never really feel like we have a reason to. But this, as a child, has always just struck me for some reason.
It's been in so many movies. Like, you know, the superheroes skateboard on it or slide on it or swing on it, you know. So, yeah, it's iconic.
Where in St. Louis is the best place to see the arch from?
I would definitely say down on the riverfront. I mean, it's 630 feet, so it's the largest structure in the city. So, I mean, being down here so low, it's just so gigantic looking.
What does the arch mean to you?
It's just always been part of my life. I mean, I work down here. It's really just always been around. I don't know. I love it. It's really cool. It's crazy to think it's already been 60 years since it's been built.
That was Alex Clayton of St. Louis, Nick and Tim Pulliam, View of Los Angeles, Barb Possell of Wisconsin, Bruce Richmond of Connecticut, and Louis Ogene of Chicago. And joining me now to talk about the Gateway Arch and recognize its 60th anniversary is architect and historian John Gunther. John is the president of the Society of Architectural Historians St. Louis chapter and author of a Reedy Press book on the history of the Gateway Arch. Thanks for coming in, John.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us is Andrew Wonko, the public historian at the Missouri History Museum. Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I don't need to tell you both, the Gateway Arch is a symbol that carries many, many different meanings for many different people. We're going to get into that this hour, but just to start us off, how do you feel and what do you find yourself reflecting on when you see the arch, Andrew?
You know, my history with the arch growing up in St. Louis is probably pretty similar to most people's. I looked at the arch first as a child when I was down there watching fireworks shows or eating a Big Mac at the Riverfront McDonald's on the riverboat and looking up at this incredible structure. I knew nothing of its history. I really didn't have any sense of understanding of why it was here or that other cities didn't have one of these giant shiny things in their front yard. But it was really when I went away to school, first to be an architect, and eventually fell in love with St. Louis history through the city's architecture, that I now look at the arch in such a different way. I am endlessly amazed at the complexity of stories that are hidden within its very sleek and simple shiny curve. You know, when you look at the arch from a distance, it looks pretty simple, but the backstory of this monument is anything but simple.
How about you, John? Was this kind of part of your inspiration in becoming an architect?
Well, I've always admired it over the years, and its form is absolutely dramatic and very, very much speaks to the Gateway to the West. Actually, I really got to know it much, much better when I began teaching mid-century modern class at Washington University, and we would take our students to 9 different iconic mid-century modern sites for the class, and the arch was always the first stop. And we learned a great deal by walking the grounds, studying it, analyzing it, and also from Bob Moore, the retired park historian. He shared a vast amount of knowledge with us.
Where's your favorite place to see the arch from?
Well, actually, walking about and standing up next to it and just looking at it soaring up to the sky and touching it, it draws you to be engaged. So I love to be right up close to it. But I also love just any vantage point is so wonderful, from the Mansion House apartments looking back over. You get a dramatic view as well. And, of course, it framing the old courthouse is very wonderful. And that was one of the things the competition jury members liked about this entry, that it actually did frame and it was in scale with the city.
And let's talk about the competition. I mean, John, you wrote the book, literally. You wrote the book on the Gateway Arch's history. And you begin at the year 1699, when the Louisiana Territory was controlled by France. We don't have time to go back that far, but it's important context for why the arch is deemed the gateway to the West. But take us back to that competition, the idea to create a monument on the riverfront.
Well, it began in 1933, and Luther Eli Smith was returning home from seeing another national monument. And as he passed by on the train and looked at the riverfront, he thought it was looking a bit run down, and he thought, why not reinvigorate this area and turn it into a memorial and a monument to Thomas Jefferson and the westward expansion?
And he was looking run down. Paint us a picture. What did it look like at that time?
Well, it was a vast amount of buildings. It was 37 blocks and about 430 buildings or so. And they were mainly warehouses and manufacturing and all sorts of industrial types of work. I will say that I don't know that it was as run down as they might have portrayed it. There was amazing architecture on the riverfront. And we had one of the best collections of cast iron fronts, which really led to the beginning of the Chicago skyscrapers per Siegfried Gideon. But they filled up every square foot. It was form follows lot. If you had a lot certain width and certain depth, that building filled the entire lot and rose as high as it could per the technology of the day.
And so there was a competition for what monument would go up there. Andrew, what were some of the other monuments that were being considered? This was a vote by, I think it was seven votes. So yeah, a group of seven people came to decide which ones would win.
Yeah, so they had seven jurors. So, you know, John was just mentioning the riverfront comes down in the early 1940s, 1941. The St. Louis riverfront has been completely cleared out for this monument. It wasn't until 1947 that they actually have this architectural competition, because a little thing happened in the middle between 1941 and 1947. World War II obviously shuts down the appetite for any sort of monument building in the United States. All of the action is focused on Europe and the Pacific. So when it opens in 1947, things have actually changed pretty dramatically in the architecture world. In the early 20th century, you have a lot of revisiting of older styles. I think when Luther Eli Smith first envisioned a memorial on the St. Louis riverfront, I don't know for sure, I certainly wasn't in his head to know, but I can imagine he was probably thinking of something pretty classical and traditional. Heroic statues of people like Thomas Jefferson and Lewis and Clark, a lot of classical Greek and Roman-inspired architecture probably. By 1947, you're moving into this new period of American history. We're suddenly the new superpower of the world. We've won the war. And architecture is changing very dramatically. The look and feel of monuments in the United States would move in this new direction where they're embracing abstraction and these very clean line geometries. So something like the arch fascinates me because it really can only come out of this one particular moment in American history. A little earlier, it would be a lot more traditional. A little later, in the revolutionary 1960s and the jaded 1970s, you can't really imagine this sort of slick, very streamlined form coming out of that period of time. So it's really born of the late 40s in this very particular way. And some of the other entries in the competition, there were 172 entries. Eero Saarinen's arch was number 144. they ran the gamut of all sorts of different things. You had an 800-foot-tall suspension bridge that would have been one of the five largest structures in the United States had it actually been built. That one was disqualified because you couldn't use a bridge as the monument. You couldn't leap across the river. That wasn't part of the monument grounds. Future St. Louis architectural great Gio Obata was a member of one team that submitted an entry as a team of students and would have had a statue of Thomas Jefferson with a 200-foot tall concrete pillar behind him, and they would have projected Jefferson's shadow up onto this pillar at nighttime. Would have had this almost like this
vibe.
Joker over Gotham City kind of vibe. But you had these incredibly abstract ideas. Edward Durell Stone, who's one of the biggest names in mid-century modern architecture, submitted a plan that would have, it almost looked kind of like a golf course where it had these bunkers and dunes and big holes punched in the landscape. There would have been no tall monument to speak of whatsoever. And so when I look back at the competition, it's fascinating and fun to see what else could have stood on the riverfront, but boy, did we get lucky that these seven individuals chose the arch, because some of these other entries would have looked dated before they had even been finished. I think Eero Saarinen's Gateway Arch obviously speaks for itself, that this is a timeless monument on par with some of the world's greatest.
And this is 630 feet tall. The arch is the tallest monument in the U.S. John, where would you say it stands in terms of notable monuments in the country or perhaps even the world? Is it really well-known worldwide?
It is absolutely well-known worldwide, and it's at the top of the list for me, absolutely. And it's so internationally recognized that it's quite a monument, and it just fulfills its obligations in every way.
Yeah, and I to add to that, one of my favorite places where you can see this in reality is looking at the board game Monopoly. They have a version called Here and Now, which replaces all of the squares on the Monopoly board with landmarks from around the United States. The front of that game box has three things on it: the Golden Gate Bridge, the Gateway Arch, and the Statue of Liberty. It's more than even just a symbol of St. Louis. It becomes a symbol of the entire center of the United States. It's this immediately recognizable image of the United States in a huge way. And I think that is a pretty, it's a small example, but it's a pretty profound look at what this thing means and the kind of weight that it carries.
We're recognizing the 60th anniversary of the Gateway Arch today, and we want you to join the conversation as well. What does the Gateway Arch symbolize to you? What questions do you have about it? You can reach us by emailing talk@stlpr.org. You can also call us at 314-382-8255. That's 314-382-TALK. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be back shortly. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from the St. Louis Public Library Foundation. During these challenging times, free access to digital resources is a necessity. You can help our community stay connected. Support your St. Louis Public Library at slpl.org.
Welcome back to our discussion about the 60th anniversary of the Gateway Arch. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Elaine Cha, and I'm joined today by St. Louis historians John Gunther and Andrew Wonko. John is an architect and the president of the Society of Architectural Historians in St. Louis, and Andrew is the public historian at the Missouri History Museum. And John, you know, during the break, you mentioned to me that this wasn't actually just one competition. This was a two-part competition to see what monument would be on the riverfront here in St. Louis.
Yes, I was struck by Andrew's comment that we were so fortunate to have the Gateway Arch selected after demolishing the riverfront, and we really were. We had no idea at that time what we were going to have as a national monument. But that said, a very key part of this was that this competition entry was created in two phases. So there was a first set of entries, and then they whittled down the list a little further to five remaining finalists, and then they went into a second phase. And so it's very fortunate that that happened, because certainly Eero Saarinen was one of the winning first phase competition entries, but so was Harris Armstrong. And in fact, Harris Armstrong got 7 out of 7 votes. and Saarinen got 6 out of 7 votes. So had it been called at the very first step of the phase of the first entry, we would have had something designed by Harris Armstrong. But he created a very bold and dynamic re-envisioning of the levee, and that actually was not allowed in the competitions. But it was so impressive, they let him go on into the second phase. So we're very, very fortunate that we had a two-part competition.
Oh, interesting. It's so interesting to know these little details that, you know, had one tiny thing been different, we'd be at a very different place today.
Right.
Well, you know, you mentioned the demolishing of, you know, what was downtown? What was on the grounds of Gateway Arch National Park before it became a national park? This was because, you know, beginning in 1935, the riverfront was designated the Jefferson National Expansion Memorial, and its ownership was transferred to the National Park Service. This is something St. Louisans voted on, and there was a huge voter turnout. There was also claims of fraud. Do we know what was going on at the time, Andrew?
Yeah, so Luther Eli Smith, who we were talking about earlier, he was the big sort of idea man behind creating a memorial on St. Louis's riverfront. This is the height of the Great Depression, when 3 out of 10 St. Louisans are out of work. A lot of those businesses along the riverfront are struggling. Property values had been chopped in half by the Great Depression, and he sees this opportunity. If we clear all of this away for a memorial to Thomas Jefferson and Lewis and Clark and westward expansion and St. Louis's role in all of that, we can revitalize the riverfront, we can create jobs during the Great Depression, and also we can get rid of this area that we are sort of seeing as an eyesore. And as John mentioned earlier, just how much of an eyesore it was probably depends on who you were asking. This was a huge undertaking, and they went to the federal government. Luther Eli Smith had worked on a memorial to George Rogers Clark in Vincennes, Indiana, and the federal government had kicked in a lot of money for this memorial. So he basically thought, we can do this again on a bigger scale in St. Louis. They were able to get federal money through Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal work creation programs during the Great Depression. They got the National Park Service to agree to run it, but it came with the caveat that St. Louisans would have to vote to self-raise the remaining $7.5 million that they needed to make this thing happen. It's a frustrating part of our history. As a historic preservationist at heart, when I look back at the pictures of what was lost on the riverfront, it absolutely breaks my heart to see the St. Louis history, you know, this landscape that had accumulated across decades of history, the important structures we had there that were wiped out in one fell swoop. It's even more frustrating when you learn that the public vote to fund this demolition probably was fraudulent. St. Louisans actually probably never voted to create the Jefferson National Expansion Memorial. The vote happens in 1935, and it comes back as being passed. But the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and a group called the Citizens Nonpartisan Committee smelled something fishy in the air. They started diving into the voting record, and they eventually uncovered more than 46,000 suspicious votes. They had things like hundreds of votes registered to a barber shop or a vacant building. They had one precinct of the city that had 506 people living in it and voted 505-0 in favor of creating this memorial. They actually filed a lawsuit to try to block this from becoming reality, but the Missouri Supreme Court eventually threw it out, claiming that after a year, those votes had become legally non-existent and the project was able to go forward. So it's a pretty good chance that St. Louisans never actually voted for this, and there was a lot of political conniving behind the scenes going on.
And you mentioned, you know, that we lost some incredible architecture, you know, culture of the city. In these 40 acres of historic downtown St. Louis, you know, there was commercial and industrial, but there was also residential. There were people living in apartments, there were neighborhoods. What do we know about the lives of those who once lived where the Gateway Arch National Park stands today?
So they chose this memorial shape for a very specific reason. It was almost identical to the original village of St. Louis that was platted in 1764 when Pierre Leclerc and Auguste Chouteau came upriver from New Orleans to create a French fur trading outpost. That outpost they created was 3 blocks deep and 19 blocks wide. The arch grounds end at 3rd Street, and they cover almost that entirety of the original plat of colonial St. Louis. It was very purposeful. because they started to see the buildings that were there, even though this riverfront had accumulated across the course of decades. And to paint a picture of what the St. Louis riverfront looked like, imagine something like New Orleans French Quarter, but a little bit more brawnier and muscular, a little bit less kind of dainty, wrought iron sort of everywhere. It was a little taller, had these big cast iron storefronts with huge windows, but it was this incredibly dense urban environment, almost like Manhattan's Lower East Side, these wall-to-wall structures. And they saw these effectively as like squatters on sacred ground. They wanted to take all of this down so they could recreate the riverfront as it was when St. Louis was helping to expand the West. And so that was the argument that was being made of why these buildings had to go. Even though they were the fur trading warehouses that had built St. Louis, they were the steamboat centers, they were the all of these incredible things, like the Simmons Hardware Company was this massive, basically like Gilded Age version of Walmart. You could buy anything you could imagine for your house was manufactured at the Simmons Hardware Company on the St. Louis Riverfront. All of these structures were tied to that story of St. Louis becoming the gateway to the West, but they did not see it that way. They wanted to go back to this sort of pastoral early American history.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned at the beginning of the hour that the arch is a symbol that carries multiple meanings for different people. You know, the arch was built to honor St. Louis's role in westward expansion, and this was a time when Manifest Destiny was used to push Native Americans and Mexicans out of their lands. You have the arch standing on grounds where a lot of, Black families had homes there, had apartments there. There's a complex history there to the arch. It is a symbol of pride for our region, and it's beautiful, but there's also, I don't know how to put it, like a mourning for kind of what was lost.
Yeah, I think this is part of the arch's complexity. And as you learn more and more about St. Louis's local history, this is where it gets kind of difficult to disentangle all those different meanings the arch has within it. A French author named Roland Barthes once said of the Eiffel Tower, it's a pure symbol. It attracts meaning the way a lightning rod attracts thunderbolts. And I think the arch is the exact same thing. Officially on paper, it's meant to designate St. Louis's role in the gateway to the West, but it means any number of things to any number of people. It's been used as a backdrop for protests. It's been used as a backdrop for family gatherings and fireworks. It's a symbol of westward expansion in a very, very pro sense of that being this really incredible moment. But it's equally, that story has another side. Chief Joe Medicine Crow, who was the Crow tribal historian who helped create the original exhibits underneath the arch, was quoted in the paper as saying, it will be a tough job not to make it all sadness. Because the flip side of that westward expansion story from the sort of Eurocentric white point of view is that you had thousands of people who were already living in this westward that they were expanding into. Lewis and Clark, after they journey to the Pacific coast and come back to St. Louis, William Clark stays in St. Louis, where he becomes the Indian agent for the federal government. From 1808 to his death in 1838, he would sign treaties with Native American groups, removing them from historic lands they occupied. He is responsible for as much as one-tenth of all of the Native American land that was removed as a part of that process of Manifest Destiny and moving out people who had lived on this land for generations so new people could be shipped in and set up farms. That's all a part of this story, too, and it's complex to disentangle.
In fact, St. Louis is known as the Mound City, and there's a reason for that because of the Native American mounds that were constructed here. And just to, slightly to the north of the Gateway Arch, there were magnificent mounds there. And even they just discovered when they were putting in the Stan Musial Parkway Bridge that there were mounds just on the other side of the river, and we know of Cahokia Mounds. So between 800 and 1200, there were more people in the year 1000 living in Cahokia Mounds area than in the city of London. So it was quite an established area.
Yeah, the arch was not the first monument on the riverfront.
Absolutely.
We have Tom joining this conversation from St. Louis. Tom, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you so much for having me and for taking my call.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's on your mind?
There are two components to my car. First of all, I have the same birthday as the arch.
Happy early birthday, Tom.
Thank you so much. I specifically remember it was Thursday, October 28th, 1965, and this was my 17th birthday. I was a senior in high school, so it was a special treat. My parents took me down to have dinner at one of the river boats on the river, and that, so it was in the shadow of the newly completed arch. So I've always, I guess, that had a special meaning for me when people were celebrating the arch. I say, well, that's my birthday too. And I actually have another connection with it, because some people might not know that Eero Saarinen's original plan for a memorial park included a national park on both sides of the river. And when Congress only appropriated money for the Missouri side, one of my former law partners, Malcolm Martin, bought 50 acres directly across from the arch. It's where the Gateway Geyser was located, and it's now part of the Metro East Park and Recreation District. But there is an ongoing effort to have that property donated to the National Park, which was actually part of Eero Saarinen's original vision 80 years ago.
Wow. Well, Tom, thank you so much for your call. And John, I know you know, you're familiar with Malcolm W. Martin Memorial Park, yes. That connection to East St. Louis and St. Louis.
Yes, it was very, very important that the that this competition span both sides of the river, and that was part of the first phase requirement. Sadly, it was dropped after the budgetary restraints. But I'm so delighted that Malcolm Martin would stay with it to have that park developed. And I was talking to Chris Pieper, one of his father's partners, and he told me that Malcolm Martin also helped to plan D-Day, World War II. And when he was there, he was studying the tides of the English Channel. He studied the landforms. He codenamed the beaches Omaha and Utah after the Union Pacific Railroad and organized personnel on landing craft and order. So he was a beachmaster on D-Day itself. So he really has a whole other aspect of his life and his history. But we are very grateful that he had the foresight to create that Malcolm Martin Park on the east side.
Yeah. I feel like in preparing for this show and digging into the arch history, there are just so many branches and tangents that you could go off those branches, so many routes, just so much history on those grounds, both on the east and west side.
Yes.
You can join our conversation as well. What questions do you have about the Gateway Arch? What does the monument symbolize to you? You can reach us at 314-382-8255. That's 314-382-TALK. And we have Jennifer on the line from Crawford County. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Good, good. So I'm a substitute teacher. I teach kindergarten to calculus, right? Whenever I get, especially middle school kids, a math class, and they don't want to do stuff for a substitute, and they'll complain, why do we need math? We have calculators. And I immediately say, has any of you guys been to the Gateway Arch? Most of them raise their hand. And I say, guess what? They didn't have calculators to build that.
Yes.
It was built with a slide rule and a pencil. They did not. It was 20 years later before people started having the smaller calculators in their back pocket.
Yeah, Jennifer, that's a great point. And, you know, I mean, how was the arch constructed? I mean, in layman's terms, I'm not going to be able to understand anything too complex, but it's an incredible structure and it's withstood for six decades.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah. And I mean, that's part of the beauty of the simpleness of that geometry is how it holds itself up. But you've got to get to the point where the legs connect at the top in order for it to hold itself up. The arch weighs an incredible amount. There are more than 12,000 tons of concrete inside the legs. I forget exactly how far under the ground they go, but digging the footings for those legs was one of the biggest challenges, was just how far they had to get down to hit bedrock and actually hold up that incredible weight. I'm always amazed at that what was just mentioned by Jennifer, that they did not have any computers. This was all done by hand calculations. We have a lot of really incredible stories and remembrances from workers who worked on the arch talking about what it was like to be up inside of that as it was going up. This is in the years before OSHA, so a lot of these men were working on tilted, slippery steel surfaces without any harnesses. And, you know, it was an actuarial firm. This gets brought up every time. The actuarial firm actually predicted that 13 people would die building the arch, and they had no deaths whatsoever. So an incredible record of safety for such an unprecedented structure. There were, I forget his name now, but we have a record from one of the iron workers who was talking about when they finally put up the creeper cranes that actually climbed up the legs of the arch, sort of like parasites latching onto this thing that they were building. Every time they would pull up a huge new weight of materials, the entire structure would lurch forward and you would have to brace yourself against the walls because you could, it was like being on a rolling ship. Every time the materials were coming up, the thing was actually moving and swaying along with the weight. It's incredible to think about. You know, a lot of times when you look at monuments, it's the mayors and politicians and architects that get their names on the monuments, but it's these hundreds of individuals who are actually doing this work on a daily basis that are the ones we should thank for the arch standing, because without them it wouldn't.
I would like to add to that, and in terms of what classes to take, I would get a shout out to Art, because Eero Saarinen trusted his eye. And actually, even before all the calculations were going on, they were making models of this design, and he trusted his eye, and he would look at it visually, did it look right, or so on. And it's actually a flattened catenary. So if
what does that mean, a flattened catenary?
So in Latin, catenary, chain. So if you held a chain upside down, it creates a natural shape. But he didn't like the fact that the bottom of that would be a little too rounded, a little too pointy, so he pushed it downward, if you will. So it's a gentler curvature at the top because he trusted his eye. And so that's a key thing to think about. Also, in terms of co-making, Carl Millis, the Swedish sculptor in residence at Cranbrook Academy, where Eelio Saarinen and Eero Saarinen were practicing and teaching and so on, he passed by one day and he saw the first phase rectangular legs of the arch. And he said, Eero, they really should be triangular. It will be much more beautiful. And so Eero took that idea and ran with it for the second phase. And he also then began to reapportion the proportions of it. It's more like what we see it today. So it's a matter of trusting your eye as well as all those calculations.
Well, we can't talk about the workers who built the arch without talking about Percy Green. In 1964, Percy Green and Richard Daley protested the exclusion of black workers from federal contracts and jobs related to the arch's construction. This was just after President Lyndon B. Johnson had signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We had an opportunity to speak with Percy Green on the show in 2015 about his protest where he scaled the arch to draw attention to this. He told us about the feeling of climbing the arch, watching the reaction on the ground more than 100 feet below him. Here's Green describing this moment where he noticed the group of demonstrators at the old courthouse, which was organized as a diversionary tactic, they start to move toward the arch.
I had binoculars myself, and so I looked over from the arch over toward the old courthouse, and I could see the picketing going on over there. And then every so often I would move my arm up and down just to try to make sure that they would see that we were on the arch. And then I also saw where the picket line was breaking up, so I suspected that they were going to bring the picket line over to the arch grounds where we were. And then, of course, the police then all came, and then they prevented the picketers from getting any closer to where we were.
What was the reaction to this protest? What do we know about what effects it had?
Yes, it's amazing to think about when the arch was being built in the mid-1960s. If you had looked across those grounds, you would see a whole college worth of trades that were required to create this monument. But among the skilled workers working there, you would not see a single black face among that entire group of people. Percy Green was challenging that. This was a federal monument that was rising. Government jobs needed to be hiring black workers as well. And he climbed 125 feet up the leg of the arch along with Richard Daley and refused to come down. He was up there for more than 4 hours. They actually went up while all of the arch workers were on lunch. So again, that sort of distraction, diversion. And he was up there for so long, and the footage is incredible. When he finally comes down, he flops onto the ground as if he's dead, and they have to carry him away on a stretcher. At first, they weren't going to arrest Richard Daley because he was white and Percy Green was black. And when they finally announced they're going to arrest him too, he flops on the ground right beside Percy Green. That was part one of what ultimately turned the arch into a civil rights landmark. The second half of that is in 1966 when they were working on the visitor's center underground in the arch. They hired a small black-owned plumbing firm to create to do some of the plumbing in the visitor center bathrooms, and all of the unionized workers on the arch grounds walked out. These two instances, Percy Green's protest and this walkout because a black group of laborers had been hired, got the U.S. Justice Department to file the first pattern of practice lawsuit. Again, this had only been made legal 2 years earlier under the Civil Rights Act of 1964, basically claiming that the St. Louis building trades unions had made a pattern of practice of not hiring black workers and intentionally excluding black skilled laborers. They got the St. Louis building trades to sign an agreement stating that they would end all practices that were discriminatory. It was the first time the federal government had ever enforced equal opportunity employment anywhere in the country. So a pretty incredible story tied to the arch that doesn't get told a whole lot.
Right. Yes, I wanted to make sure that we mentioned that the actions of Percy Green and Richard Daley did lead to the Equal Employment Opportunity Act nationwide. And if you think about what can one or two people do, that is truly a very moving thought. I would also say there's another association with the north leg of the arch, if I may, and that was the location of the Papin Building, and that was the site of the first federal Dred Scott trial in 1854. They were renting space. The first two trials were held at the old courthouse. The third trial was held in rented space in the Papin Building on First Street. And if you were to find that location going back in history, it's near the north leg of the arch. So I think of the north leg of the arch as the civil rights leg of the arch.
Oh, wow. So interesting. And that's, of course, that's the third trial before Dred Scott v. Sanford.
Exactly.
In the Supreme Court.
That was, yeah, and they were represented by Roswell Field. We know of the Field House Museum, and Roswell defended them. And when they were denied their freedom, it went up to the Supreme Court, and that was the precipitator to the Civil War. So it's a very, very important location in our country for history.
As the arch was being completed, I was actually talking with local historian Vivian Gibson the other day. She had signed or written something. She couldn't remember exactly what she wrote, but she wrote in a time capsule that was included in the arch. It was literally built into it. And it sounds like Roseanne of St. Louis also has a similar memory. Roseanne, you're on St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you so much. I was in sixth grade, as I recall, Clayton School District, Glenridge School, elementary school, and we were asked in my class to sign a piece of paper, and that our signatures would go into a time capsule. And when I went online to Google this, thank goodness for Google, it said that 700,000 signatures of school children were put into this time capsule, and it's welded in. The time capsule is welded to the top of the arch, according to this article I see.
Yes, that's true. 762,000 people signed the signatorium sheets, and they were placed into there was a void. It's a double skin structure, the arches. And so the void at the very top in the keystone, the last piece to go in, that's where those pieces of signatures are, those papers with the signatures. And they are up there permanently as it was locked into place on October 28th.
Roseanne, thank you so much for your call. And we need to take a short break, but if you would like to join our conversation, you can reach us by calling 314-382-8255. That's 314-382-TALK. We'll be back to continue this short conversation shortly. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts. Mm-hmm.
Welcome back. Today we're talking about the tallest monument in the United States, none other than the Gateway Arch, which turns 60 years old tomorrow. And with us are St. Louis historians Andrew Wonko and John Gunther. And we're hearing from you. If you'd like to join our conversation, share your favorite Gateway Arch memory, if you have questions about how it was built, you can reach us at 314-382-8255. And we have David on the line. David, you're from Creve Coeur. Welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you for taking my call. Many years ago, I flew practically halfway around the world to Australia, my first time visiting Sydney. And then I went to the famous Opera House, and I'm listening to the tour guide, and I couldn't believe that he would mention St. Louis in his speech. And he mentioned what I remember was the curvature of the famous Sydney Opera House. They were looking for a way to build that into the Sydney Opera House, and they looked to the St. Louis Arch on how it had constructed its curvature. So I wanted to, I think that's how I remember the story. So can you confirm that there's a connection between the St. Louis Arch and the Sydney Opera House?
And what do you think, Joe? Go ahead. What finish that thought, David.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing I wanted to, I was born in 1965, so I'm 60. And I just wanted to know, I know about my longevity. I'm not sure what my longevity is left. What is the longevity of the arch? Will it last for 100 years, 150 years?
Yeah. If you can David, thank you so much for your call. John, well, on that first point,
yes, the
Sydney Opera House and the Arch, is there a connection there?
There's absolutely a connection, and one that goes right to the core of it. Eero Saarinen helped pick that competition winner. He arrived late to the jury, and when he got there, he went through all the entries. And this entry for the Sydney Opera House, as we know it today, was off to the side in the rejected piles. And he pulled that out, and he says, "This is your winner." And so he's very responsible for the selection of that building design that we see today. So that's a very direct connection. In terms of how long this building will stand, Saarinen felt that it should be done in a modern material, and stainless steel would last as long as civilization itself. So really an indeterminate amount of time.
Really?
Yes.
So 60 plus years?
Well into the future. Yes,
wow,
yes, yes.
Wow, that's incredible. I mean, it does look, I don't know how much of it has been replaced at any time, but it looks the same as it did 60 years ago.
Yeah, there was a study done about 15 years or so ago about the skin, and it is holding up beautifully. Any kind of stains that you might see on it was attributed to a couple of things. One was that there's air pollution, and it was recording the air pollution of the city, and I'm happy to say it's getting cleaner and cleaner, so there's less and less staining. And there might have been some staining from the weld joints. But that said, it is really solid.
One of my favorite presentations of the arch in the distant future comes from a 1979 book called Motel of the Mysteries, written by David McCauley. It's a satire of these sort of, you know, future archaeologists return to the United States and they discover a roadside motel and they treat it the way we would uncover an Egyptian pyramid or something, like the toilet is clearly a throne for some god. And the arch is in this book, in this sort of future United States. It's buried under 500 something feet of trash, and all you can see is the very top of the arch sticking out of the trash. And people like to, tourists like to visit the arch so they can kiss the underside of it the way they, and imagine
like
that once upon a time, this used to stand so high over everyone's head. So just a kind of funny look that incorporates the arch criticism of America.
A cautionary tale about littering. Scott is joining the conversation from St. Louis. Scott, you're on St. Louis on the Air. You have an arch connection?
Yes, my father, he drove a bulldozer, was a construction worker. So he worked in the early part of construction of the arch, and he passed when I was pretty young. They both did the excavation, basically burying that rail line that's there, goes north and south of the arch, and also the excavation for the legs. And I never really got it. He passed when I was young, so I didn't really have much of a chance to speak with him about, his recollections. But I do know that, I've heard that a lot of the construction workers at the time, they were very proud of the work that they did. And especially at the time when nothing had come up yet, they're just doing the prep work for the actual construction. So didn't know if there's any kind of stories or anything
recollection of anything of that early, those early 1963-64 infancy stages of the arch construction.
Yeah, thanks for your call, Scott.
Regarding the very first project associated with the Gateway Arch, it was the relocation of the train tracks 100 feet or so to the west. And so they were buried into the hillside, and they're partially underground in tunnels, and they're also partially open to the sky to help with ventilation. Actually, Mayor Dickman was an engineer, and he actually proposed such a solution. But at any rate, that was 1959 when those the train tracks were relocated. In terms of the excavation that your father probably worked on, that was begun in 1962. And it's interesting to note that they dug about 45 to 50 feet into the bedrock to lock in the footings of this great structure. And it took 23 hours of continuous concrete pour. Concrete trucks showed up for 23 hours in a row to pour the foundations for the south leg of the arch.
Well, and John, what do we know about... So, you know, we have the structure, we know what it's made out of, but how did they get such a perfect arch? And how did they line it up? You know, we talked about they didn't have calculators. Right. How did they do that?
Well, it was an amazing design, not only by the architects, but by the engineers Severud, Elstad, and Kruger. And Hans Carl Bondell was the chief engineer. But it's truly remarkable when you think about it. It begins 54 feet wide. It's an equilateral triangle, 54 feet wide at the bottom. And by the time you reach the top at 630 feet, it is 17 feet wide. For the first 300 feet, it is a double skin. It's stainless steel on the outside, carbon steel on the inside with a 3-foot gap filled with concrete and rebar. So that locks it into those foundations deep into the bedrock of the earth. At 300 feet on up, it's a double skin, outer stainless steel, inner carbon steel, but it's a hollow space that leads the rest of the way. But if you think about it, every vertical foot that it rises, it is changing its dimensions and proportions. How they realized this, and they used to measure after each section, they called them cans, the triangular cans. After each can was set at night and welded into place, the engineers would triangulate. They would take measurements, survey measurements, and they would triangulate to a Christmas tree light on the inner point of the triangle of the arch. And they would measure in space, down to the ground, and into a benchmark. And they would calculate exactly so that it would come perfectly together, 630 feet above them, with just a fraction of an inch, plus or minus.
I'd like to squeeze in one more call. Jim from Fairview Heights. Jim, you are on St. Louis on the Air. What's your arch story?
As a senior in college, I was home for Labor Day weekend, and me and a few other buddies, I and a few other buddies climbed up the outside of the arch. It was probably close to 600 feet. At the time, there was a platform up there, and they had the net between the two legs. We ended up staying a while and then scooting on our rear ends down the steps on the inside. We could see the bare light bulbs hanging every few feet or every, I don't know, 20, 30 feet. We thought we'd be arrested when we got down under the arch, but we didn't. There weren't any guards. The gates were open. By this time, it was getting light out. We were in the area where they put the museum. We just ran down to the riverfront and got in our car and drove home.
Wow, Jim, that is quite a story.
Yeah, Jim, you are a braver man than I, and it sounds like you've lived to change your ways. But certainly for a lot of people, that's one of the fascinating things about the arch. Something about being in the presence of this giant shiny object. It's like a bad behavior unleasher almost. You know, you talk to the National Park Service rangers, they have to deal with a lot of stuff on the arch grounds, ranging from, you know, public urination to domestic disputes. That's all pretty small scale stuff. I think one of the biggest issues they probably deal with on a daily basis is people scratching their names into the bottom of the arch legs. That's just this giant shiny canvas, and people just can't resist. The first name was scratched into the base of the arch 1 month after its public dedication. So this is something they have dealt with since it was built. But every once in a while, you get stories like this where it's a little bit more serious. It doesn't happen anymore. Surveillance, thankfully, has kind of put an end to it. But in the early years, you had at least a dozen planes that were flown through the legs of the arch, including one helicopter that was flown through the arch's legs, even though the Federal Aviation Administration said they would ban the license of any pilot who tried such a thing. And then one of the most famous ones was in 1992. A daredevil named John Vincent actually climbed up the side of the arch using suction cups, the kind you would use to, like, pick up a piece of glass. And then when he got to the top, he parachuted off down to the bottom. He was at his trial for doing this. He was told by a judge he had been given a gift of courage, but that he abused it. And while he initially was given jail time, he eventually got that taken down to like a $1,000 fine and community service. But for some people, it's just they feel like they have to conquer it.
Wow. Yeah. Well, shout out to the park rangers who, you know, do their best to keep things in check. And we should mention and acknowledge, we did reach out to Gateway Arch National Park to see if someone from the national park would be able to come on. Of course, they're affected by the government shutdown right now, so we had not heard back from them. You know, in our final 30 seconds, I wonder if each of you could reflect on what's kind of the biggest lesson that stems from the arch that you take with you today.
I think the incredible thing about the arch when I look at it is this transferable lesson that history is neither good nor bad. It's always complex. The arch, we lost St. Louis's historic riverfront. The arch is this thing that has, you know, it's a civil rights icon. It's been used as a backdrop for protests. It's also a part of people's dear family memories, and it's a beautiful piece of architecture. It can be all those things at once.
And John, in five words or less, what's your takeaway?
That it realized Luther Eli Smith's hopes. Inspirational design. Design beautiful, rise above the norm, symbolize American culture and civilization, and attract people from other nations.
Local historians John Gunther and Andrew Wonko, thank you so much for joining us today. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Emily Woodbury. Do you have a favorite memory or story involving the Gateway Arch? We'd love to hear from you. Leave us a voicemail for a future St. Louis on the Air mailbag segment. You can reach us at 314-516-6397. That's 314-516-NEWS.
This episode was produced by Emily Woodbury,
with production assistance from Maya Norfleet, Danny Wisentowski, Darius Barner, and Olivia Meisel. Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
When you tell a friend you listen to St. Louis on the Air, you help connect us to new people who care about their community. We're easy to find online, where you can listen to any of our past segments for free. Just search for St. Louis on the Air on any of your favorite streaming platforms, like Spotify, Apple Podcasts on the App Store, or YouTube.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.